Right. Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you're doing well. It is moi. C'est philosophie. C'est moi. It is Stéphane Molyneux. Oh, Tuesday, the 23rd of December, 2025. I hope you're having a lovely day. I did have a little bit of time today. And boy, the weather up here is frightful. It is absolutely frightful. But that's no worries. We enjoy the winter wonderland stuff. And, you know, the joyful thing, of course, is that every day is, in fact, a blessing from the universe and something we should be overjoyed to experience. You know, it's funny. I'm sure if you've had this, like you get sick, oh, and a cold or a flu or something like that. And everybody has a lot of problems until they get sick. And then the only problem they have is being sick. So I hope that you will appreciate your health and work to maintain it. It's the one thing that we should never take for granted, because boy, when it goes, and you know, there's a time when your health will go and not come back. Hey, that's going to be exciting, isn't it? The time when your health goes and doesn't come back. All right. So I have, of course, happy to take questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems, criticisms, whatever is on your mind. But also, not only, but also, this woman wrote, "The thing that makes me so mad about the women aren't having kids discourse is all the blame is placed on the women. Millennials got effed in all the wrong ways. We were all told to go to college and not to marry young. Even if a woman wanted to marry young, the men her age were not ready. So her options would have been to date older, but how would she meet those men? Very few non-slutty ways to meet older men." Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? And I don't want to get into my youth, but I will certainly say, I mean, I had a family member who married pretty young. I was certainly interested in marrying young and starting a family young, but the women were ambitious. The women, you know, wanted to go to college and wanted to start various high-status careers. I knew a woman, of course, she wanted to be an actress. Another woman wanted to get in the film industry. Another woman wanted to be a professor. And it was all delay, delay, delay. And I would say approximately 3,000% of the declining birth rate can be laid at the feet of people delaying marriage. Now, with regards to sort of who's to blame, who's responsible, who was responsible for me not getting married into my 30s? Women. No, I'm kidding. Who was responsible for me not getting married into my 30s? Well, me. It was my responsibility. Now, the only thing I can say is that I'm in my 60th year. And what that means is I didn't really have access to any counter-propagandistic information, or I had very little access to counter-propagandistic information when I was younger. However, I did know people who got married young. One of my roommates, when I was, for those of you who don't know, sort of kicked my mom out when I was about 15, took in roommates, had 2 to 3 jobs at times. And one of my roommates from back then got married young and just started pumping out the kids. So I can't claim that it wasn't around or I didn't see it. For me, and I suppose this is one of the harsher truths about life as a whole, for me, you can't meet quality until you are quality. You can't get a quality job until you are a quality employee. You can't ask for a lot of value in an economic sense unless you're willing and able to provide a lot of value. And I felt that I had a lot of value to offer, but I could not find quality women who appreciated it. I don't know if you've ever had this, like your first couple of jobs, you may not feel like a very good employee. Mostly because when you start working, your managers tend to be absolute crap, because good managers end up managing not entry-level people, right? The best managers are managing professionals and high-performance people and so on, because it's higher skill, right? You don't put your best surgeons on Band-Aid duty for obvious reasons. So I just couldn't find the quality women. I would say that there were certainly some women that I was attracted to who were, I think, higher quality, but as a whole, you know, they had boyfriends or we weren't in sync, or I had this thing with women that even if I was attracted to them and they seemed reasonably high quality and we hung out a lot, I could not get them. It's a wild thing to me. I could not get them to commit to dating me, even though we would hang out quite a bit and enjoy each other's company and so on. I couldn't get them to commit to dating me. And listen, I mean, I'm not to everyone's taste. I will certainly accept that, and that's no problem at all. But what I found quite surprising with these higher quality women, like the women who, you know, were smart and attractive and funny and seemed like they could get just about any guy they could get. But the wild thing was to me that as I was hanging around these women, and, you know, as it turns out, although I wouldn't necessarily say that I would have been a great husband in my sort of early mid-20s, but, you know, by the time I went to therapy and worked out some of my stuff, I've been a good husband and a good father and a decent provider. And freedomain.com/donate. Oh yeah, let's provide. But what was amazing to me was that the high quality women, and I'm sure this is the case for women looking at men too, but I don't have that perspective. But the highest quality women, the guys they ended up with were not great. A lot of pretty boys and a lot of guys who had that confidence that quality men know is entirely artificial. You know, one of the marks of personalities without empathy, like the antisocial personality disorders, the sociopaths and so on, is that they don't really experience fear. They may experience caution, you know, if they're in danger, but they don't really experience fear. So they look courageous. These are the guys who could just walk up to a woman with no fear and talk to her and so on. Like, I remember there was a guy in my high school who had that kind of confidence. And I remember one girl asked to borrow a black marker of his and he drew all over her face. And she was laughing, and he was considered a really attractive guy because he just had all this confidence. And confidence to men is, particularly young men, is a sign of danger. Like, what reason do you have to be confident when you're young? You're still largely untested. You haven't gone through the fires and tribulations of life. You really don't know what your potential is when you're young. And people assume they have sort of endless massive potential when they're very young. Tend to be vainglorious, megalomaniac, megalomaniacal, delusions of grandeur. I mean, I think it's okay for me to say, in my 60th year, as I mentioned, I think it's okay for me to say, yeah, I think I've got some pretty good potential. I still have potential to mine, but I've done, I think, quite a lot. And I was always kind of surprised when I try and do something new. I'm like, hey, I could do this pretty well. I remember I knew I was a pretty good programmer because I studied it a lot on my own when I was in my teens, but I was kind of surprised at how good a programmer I was when it became my career. I remember being on a business call, like a sales call with a salesman, and this was to check up on an existing client, and the existing client was angry and upset and, you know, actually quite threatening. And the salesman was kind of... And I sort of jumped in, and with emotional skills I didn't even really know that I possessed, I calmed down the client. I made commitments. I made promises. I averted a lawsuit. Ended up being very happy and loyal, right? It's not problems that people have with you. It's how you handle them that determines the quality of the relationship. And I didn't even realize I had those negotiation skills. So it wasn't like I learned about any of my potential in school, because the only thing that school tests your potential for is enduring absolute useless boredom. Borny, bored and horny. That's the high school experience. Bored and horny. It's a pretty terrible combo. So the highest quality girls, and it's funny, you know, like over 40 years later, 45 years later, I could still list off their names. It's like burned into your brain through hormones and the tsunami of desire. But the guys they chose weren't great. I remember there was a girl in high school, very funny, smart, and attractive. And, you know, guys were all over her in terms of being around and being flirty and stuff like that. And I remember she got in a class of like 25 people or something like that. She got, I don't know, something like I think she got like 20 Valentine's Day cards because this is a Valentine's Day thing. So she got them from the guys, and I think I'm pretty sure statistically she got them from a bunch of the girls too, or at least some. And who did she choose? She had her choice of a guy who later went on to become a professor, a guy who later went on to become a professional writer, I suppose me at the time, who, you know, became an entrepreneur and did reasonably well. And she chose a truck driver, a guy who ended up being a truck driver. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. So as far as sort of responsibility, the way that I look at it is this. It's kind of like SSRIs. I don't believe in SSRIs. Just my personal opinion. I'm not a doctor. I mean, there's some data behind it, but whatever, right? I don't believe in SSRIs. Maybe extreme depression, you can do something with them that's somewhat valuable, but I don't really believe in them. And the chemical imbalance theory has been roundly disproven. I mean, there was doubts about it in the 90s, but it's been roundly disproven recently. It doesn't matter. And then what people do is they say, well, I got on these because the doctor has told me, and it seemed to be the common wisdom, and so on, right? But I always look for the hidden benefits, not just the visible costs, but the hidden benefits, what people in the mental health profession will sometimes call the secondary gains. So if a woman stays with a man after he cheats on her, or vice versa, the secondary gain could be, well, because he cheated on her, she now has largely unquestioned power over him, because she can always say, hey, you cheated on me. Remember that time you cheated? So she's always going to win. So because him cheating on her gives her power, she actually gets secondary gains from him cheating, right? Secondary gains. People who claim to be victims get the secondary gain of power. They get power over others, because if you perceive someone as a victim, then you will generally give that person additional resources, right? Such a victim, got to help out. And so this is one of the reasons why, you know, certain demographies in the West simply cannot stop being victims, because they're too well paid for being victims. Too many secondary gains. So what I do when I look at these kinds of things, when I look at something like SSRIs, I say, okay, well, there was some junk science in my view. And if you ask, you know, like real experts from what I've seen, and you can check out Roger Whitaker's work on this, because they say, well, you have a chemical imbalance. These pills correct that chemical imbalance. So it's like insulin for diabetes, right? You wouldn't feel bad about taking insulin for diabetes, would you? And then when pressed on this, well, what is the chemical imbalance? How do you measure it? And they say, well, it's really just an analogy. It's not like there's really this chemical imbalance that we can measure and test. It's just an analogy. We say, it's like insulin for diabetes. Well, I mean, that seems fairly important. It's a fairly important distinction, because insulin for diabetes, like you measure the insulin levels, you find out if somebody has diabetes, and then you can give them the right dosage, and you're correcting a loss. What is it, the pancreas or something like that produces the insulin? I'm not exactly an expert on this kind of stuff, but there's measurable stuff. You don't just kind of hand it out. And people should guess that, of course, by the fact that, you know, we'll try you on this medication. If it doesn't work, we'll try you on this, and then we'll try this combo, and we'll try the other, and then next thing you know, you're on four SSRIs and invisible ants are crawling up your spine from here to eternity. So when I look at people making decisions, and they say, well, but it wasn't really me, this is what I was told and accepted and blah, 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 right? I always look for the secondary gains. And I would suggest that you try this approach as well. And the secondary gains go something like this. So if you have, let's say, abusive parents, and just to remind everyone, if you haven't been in this conversation for a while, the worst form of abuse in my, obviously, amateur hierarchy, the worst form of abuse is sexual abuse. The second worst form of abuse is neglect. And the third worst form of abuse is verbal abuse. And the least worst form of abuse is physical abuse, sexual abuse for obvious reasons. Neglect, because it doesn't give people bad skills, it gives them no skills, right? You isolate, you often hide out, and you're just missing out on these kinds of social skills. And because it's neglect, it's not a vivid loss. It's not a vivid form of abuse. It's not a vivid loss. So it's really hard to deal with. Absence is hard to deal with. The presence of an abusive father is difficult to deal with. The absence of a father sometimes can be more difficult because you don't have anything to work with. You're working with a kind of void. So if you have abusive and or neglectful parents, then often you will end up depressed, anxious, unhappy, dysfunctional, problems relating to people, problems with empathy, problems with self-esteem, and all that. And then there's the people who say, well, that's really tough. I really do sympathize. It's really tough. So what you kind of need to do is maybe go to therapy, confront your parents, work out what was deficient in them, figure out the effects that it's had upon you, learn how to have more compassion for yourself, learn how to get angry, learn how to have boundaries, learn to have all of these things that your parents generally did not allow you to have or actively opposed you even remotely developing. Learn how to have virtues and morals and consistency and integrity. And that's a difficult multi-year journey. For me, I remember very clearly when I first started to get into self-knowledge, I was reading a book in a university called Lakehead, I think it is, a university in Thunder Bay, or as it's locally known, Thunder Bay, in Thunder Bay, the sleeping giant in Ontario. I was working based out of there for my work up north, and I was reading The Psychology of Self-Esteem, which I came in through a friend who was into Rush. Neil Peart was into Objectivism. I read Ayn Rand. Through Ayn Rand, I got into Nathaniel Brandon, and The Psychology of Self-Esteem is a very good book about self-knowledge. And prior to that, when I had a negative feeling, I just took a deep breath and pushed it away. And it was in that process I began, when I had negative feelings, I just tried to let them inform me. I accepted them. I assumed that they were of value. And I stopped just viewing negative feelings as a wasp to be avoided or swatted away, but never, never to be allowed to land on you and inject its petty venom. Madness! And through that process, I remember I was reading the book on a bus in the winter, going to the gym, because I had a gym membership at Lakehead University, when I was 18 or 19. 19, I guess, because there was still grade 13 back then, so you graduated at 18, then I went immediately to work up north, gold panner prospector, and then when I was in town, I enjoyed going to the gym. Well, I wouldn't say I quite enjoyed going to the gym, but I found it valuable to go to the gym. I've never really loved working out, but it is something that seems quite important. So from that process, at 19, I didn't go into therapy. Well, I tried going into therapy earlier, but I just had you can tell when somebody's just bored and burnt out and not listening and so on. So I tried therapy earlier. And then at the tail end of an on and off again 7-year relationship where I had proposed and then withdrew that proposal, I needed therapy. And I tried again. And it took. And it worked. It was late 20s. So 10 years. 10 years. Now, through my pursuit of self-knowledge and journaling and writing and talking and thinking, I certainly had made a lot of progress in 10 years, but I wasn't really ready for someone like my wife, who is, of course, a mental health professional. She knows her stuff. And so she plays at a very high level, and I needed to up my game in therapy. Certainly helped with that. And then through the process of therapy, I had confrontations with people in my life who had done me wrong, or at least I had perceived that they did me wrong. And, you know, one of the reasons why I recommend talking to people who've done you wrong is you find out if you're right or not. Right? So if you go to someone and say, hey, man, I think you did me really wrong. I think you did me down and dirty. I think you did me wrong. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. Please tell me more. I'll do everything I can and blah, 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 blah. And they're really sort of civilized and reasonable and healthy and good and all kinds of stuff, right? Then maybe you were wrong about them doing wrong, and maybe the wrong had more to do with you not saying stuff, you not being honest. Because, you know, people aren't psychic, and if somebody's doing something that is annoying or negative or harmful to you, you kind of should tell them, unless they're, you know, going at your knee tendon to the Black and Decker drill or something like that. But you should sort of tell them, and people can't read your mind and so on, right? So maybe when you think someone did you wrong, what actually happened was you didn't tell them. You didn't inform them, right? So if you don't like, I don't know, hillbilly thrash punk as a music form, and your boyfriend really likes it, and you say, oh, I really like this too, and he plays it a lot, but it drives you crazy, and then eventually you say to him, God, I hate this music. Why do you keep inflicting it on me? Well, that's not him being in the wrong. That's you being in the wrong by not being honest and saying, I do not like hillbilly thrash punk metal, whatever, right? So sometimes you get mad at people when what you're really mad at is yourself. I'm really mad at this person. Well, have you been honest and told them what's bothering you? No. Well, then you're probably more mad at yourself for withholding facts from people, for feeling helpless in that way. So the reason why it's important to sit down and talk with people who've done you wrong is you find out if you're right or not. And when I sat down with the people in my life who did me wrong, in general, overall, in broad strokes, they did me more wrong. Oh, that never happened. Oh, you're being paranoid. Oh, you're crazy. Oh, that's nuts. Oh, that's ridiculous. Why didn't you say anything at the time? I couldn't have known, blah, blah, when it was like really obvious bad things, right? So you find out if you're right about people doing you wrong. Did they do you wrong? Because if you go and talk to them about it and they do more wrong, well, then you found out something pretty important, right? You found out something pretty important, which is that they're bad people who do wrong. Seems pretty important. So you have those conversations. That's really tough. And then, of course, you have to go through the whole process of figuring out what you're going to do when you realize that you're surrounded by people who are kind of cold-hearted and don't care that they do you wrong and may, in fact, even enjoy doing you wrong. They may be sadists. They're right? Certainly cold, selfish, willing to sacrifice your interests at the drop of a hat just to preserve their own vanity. So you might find out that you've got a whole lot of bad people in your life. Oh, that's not fun. That's not fun because then you have to, well, you have to do your house cleaning, right? You got to clean up. What do you do with people? You say, hey, you know, you did me a bunch of wrong. Here's what happened. Here's what my experience was, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not happy with that. And they just keep doing more and more stuff that's wrong. They keep doing more and more stuff that's negative. What do you do? Well, that's tough. Because you can't make them better. You can't make them better. I mean, we all know that, I mean, I assume those of us who are here, we all know we're not psychologists, right? Or psychiatrists. But if you have someone around you who's kind of like a sociopath, right? Failure to conform to social norms or laws, repeated unlawful acts leading to arrests or legal issues, deceitfulness, repeated lying, conning, or using aliases for personal gain, impulsivity, failure to plan ahead, reckless decisions without forethought, irritability and aggressiveness, frequent fights or assaults, quick to anger, reckless disregard for safety, endangering self or others without concern, irresponsibility, repeated failure to sustain work or honor financial obligations, lack of remorse, indifference or rationalizing harm caused to others, superficial charm or wit to manipulate others, often co-occurs with substance abuse disorders, impulsivity issues, other mental health conditions, and so on. And this is just colloquial stuff, right? Sociopathy, often linked more to environmental factors such as trauma, may involve erratic impulsive behavior with occasional guilt. Psychopathy, more innate or genetic, characterized by calculated manipulation, emotional detachment, and a complete lack of remorse. These both fall under antisocial personality disorders. And I looked all of this kind of stuff up when I was confronting people in my life. And I didn't have this particular fact in this particular way. But if you ask, this is from Grok, can sociopathy be cured? Again, none of this is medical or psychological advice. We're just talking about this stuff in a colloquial fashion. No! Sociopathy, commonly referred to as antisocial personality disorder, is not considered curable. Experts view it as a chronic, lifelong personality disorder characterized by a persistent pattern of disregard for others' rights, lack of empathy, impulsivity, deceitfulness, and often aggressive or manipulative behavior. Why? It's not curable. Personality disorders like antisocial personality disorder, sociopathy, psychopathy, are deeply ingrained patterns of thinking and behaving that develop early in life, often rooted in childhood conduct issues, and remain stable over time. Reputable sources, including Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, and Medical News Today, explicitly state there is no cure. There's no specific medication or therapy that eliminates the core traits. Some symptoms might be manageable, and some individuals experience natural improvement with age, often starting in the 30s or 40s with reduced impulsivity and aggression. It's hormonal changes, aging out, just kind of getting worn out and burned out. So, yeah, it can't be fixed. Like, even if somebody ends up in an institution, like they end up institutionalized, the people who have complete control over them cannot fix them at all. Cannot fix them at all. You can force them into therapy. You can do just about anything. And you can medicate them. You can give them whatever therapies you consider beneficial. They cannot be fixed. So if professionals with total control and decades of training and experience can't fix highly dysfunctional people, your or my amateur asses certainly can't. It's sort of like seeing somebody with a tumor. Oh, they got a tumor. That's terrible. It's okay, man. I've got a spork, some Vaseline, and some Pam non-stick spray. I'm sure we can fix it. No, you can't. You really, really can't. So secondary gains, right? Secondary gains. Why do people run to pills? And this goes back to the question of why do women defer having families? Because if women said, no, I'm really not going to have sex until there's a commitment leading to marriage or marriage, right? Old school, right? Then men would conform to that because men, well, apparently I've read somewhere, maybe in a bathroom stall, that we like sex. There was a study where an attractive stranger went up to someone of the opposite sex and suggested going to bed together. Almost 60% of men said yes, 0% of women said yes. For obvious biological reasons that many multiples, fewer men reproduced throughout history than women, because the men were slaves or monks or economically disabled in some way or just leftovers and so on. So, you know, women reproduced, men, not so much. Sometimes it was many multiples, like 3, 4, 5 or more times women reproducing than men. So, yeah, women control this kind of stuff. Now, they say, you know, the old saying that women control access to sex, men control access to relationships. Well, if women as a whole didn't want to have sex or were able to grit their teeth and say, look, until we've got something that's at least heading towards marriage, doesn't have to be marriage necessarily, but it's heading towards marriage, until that's going down, no, we're not imploding the squishy bits or making the beast with two backs or anything like that. We're not starting the fire of life. Well, then that's what would happen. So why do people run to pills for their mental ills? Because, of course, it's a lot harder to do the high, hard road of integrity, honesty, confrontation, and virtue. That's hard. And I said this from the very beginning of the show. Turn back! If you know what's good for you, turn back! The music is reversible, but time is not! Turn back, turn back, turn back! And told people, look, if you go down the road of philosophy, it's going to turn you inside out. Or as I wrote in a poem when I was 17, in order to be resurrected, we first have to be put into the grave first. Like, we have to first be put into the grave in order to get a new life. And it feels like you're dying. There's the song Asylum by Supertramp, sort of very moving song. I believe I'm dying. When he's letting go of his false self and trying to get to the truth. Trying to get to reality, trying to get to the facts. So people run to pills for the secondary gain of avoiding confrontation. I mean, if somebody had diabetes and the doctor said, well, you know, I think your parents were pretty mean. You need to go and have honest conversations with them, however difficult and unpleasant that will be, and then your diabetes will be cured, people would say, that's insane. What are you talking about? I can't go cure my diabetes by having honest conversations with my parents. So people like to avoid those conversations because those conversations are really hard. It's the Ozempic thing, right? You know, if you gain weight, and I say this as a guy who dropped 30 plus pounds about 15 years ago, I mean, it kind of sucks in a way. It really does kind of suck it away. There's a reason why like 97% of people gain back, or sometimes even more, all the weight they lose on a diet. Because when you fat cells are easy to form, but they're hard to get rid of. Like, it's easy to make a vampire, it's hard to get rid of a vampire. And so when you overeat or you underexercise, then you get new fat cells very easily, but you can't get rid of them. I mean, maybe after 10 years, cell death or something like that, but they just shrink, they don't go away, and they're very easy to refill. So I have had to constantly watch what I eat over the last 15 years. Maybe I'd need to do it a little bit less now, but I've had to constant battle, right? It's like this Notting Hill. Julia Roberts plays a movie star, basically says, I've been hungry for 20 years, because she has to stay that thin, right? So, you know, losing weight and keeping it off is tough. It's a lot easier to take a pill like Ozempic, no matter what the side effects, because then you're just managing negative side effects. Well, I could get negative side effects from Ozempic, but I'll certainly get negative side effects from being fat, being obese. So yeah, I've never been able to go back to the way that I used to eat. Never. I mean, I'm not perfect about it. I still yo-yo a couple of pounds here and there, but it's, you know, it's like I'm going to spend the rest of my life holding this helium balloon underwater. And then if I work out more, I don't know if I'm eating more because I'm working out more, my muscles need the food, or who knows, right? So it's a lot easier to pop a pill than not only to diet and keep it off, which is hell in a way, but also to figure out why you got fat in the first place. Why didn't people say anything? What were you self-medicating? Why do you have this relationship to food? I grew up in such a traumatic situation that I never feel full. I always have to push food away and say, I don't think I need to eat anymore. I don't really know, because I don't really get those physical symptoms of feeling full. I never feel full. And that's, you know, a trauma response to a really chaotic childhood, because if you're in a really chaotic environment, you should eat to excess because you don't know where your next meal is coming from. So I assume, I don't know, but I assume that the leptin or whatever it is that makes you feel full doesn't get produced with people who've gone through a lot of stress and trauma as children, because that programs your body to overeat because you don't know when your next meal is coming from. And so, yeah, I remember even as a kid going to a McDonald's party, birthday party for a friend of mine, and everybody was like groaning. They were so full. And the mom was like, finally, like, okay, is everybody done? And I'm like, I could do another fillet of fish. Everyone thought I was joking. I didn't get the fillet of fish. I can tell you, I wasn't joking. I could do another fillet of fish. But that is the reality. So it's just a lot easier. So with young women, say, well, I didn't know, but you have to be really strict and harsh. I'm telling you, to be really strict and harsh. And you have to say, okay, so let's see here. The culture dangled, what did they dangle in front of me as a young woman? What did the culture dangle? The culture dangled, ooh, school, university. Ooh, that's fun. I'm going to be around a lot of hot guys, get to go to a lot of parties. I can act in plays. I can do karaoke. There's a free gym. It's a daycare. It's a daycare that runs on generally anti-white stuff, but it's a daycare. I took university exceedingly seriously because I had just spent all this time working up north in minus 35, 40 degree weather. So I was very, very keen to be in university, but very few people there took it seriously. It was a daycare. It was a blast. It was fun. People got drunk. People tried drugs. People slept around. And I remember being quite shocked when I went to university, because I thought that was going to be harder than high school. And you've got, I don't know, what, 10, 12 hours of classes a week. The rest of the time is your own. So you are bribed with laziness and hedonism. And that's the secondary gain called university. You are bribed with laziness and you are bribed with hedonism. And this is the government. This is the government. So if it were a free market environment, if it were not government mandated or run, and of course, as we know, one of the reasons why people have to go to university is because IQ tests aren't allowed. An IQ test you could do in an hour or two or three, And it is the best predictor by far of your success in a complex environment, a complex job, a cognitively demanding job. It's like a 0.7 or 0.8 correlation between IQ tests and success in complicated jobs. So in a free market environment, how would higher education be handled? Well, first of all, you wouldn't graduate completely useless economically from 12 or 13 years of government schools. I mean, I can't even tell you how enraging. I mean, they just fracking took away thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of my life. It was like being in prison. I hated school as a whole. I was forced to be there. I had to be there. And they're just robbing people of 2/3 of their childhoods. It's a butchery of young minds. And you can see this, that kids get less and less creative, less and less happy the longer they're in government schools. I mean, they're just sanding down your brain into dusty atoms of bullshit propaganda. It's absolutely horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. I can't even tell you, like, I try not to touch that level of volcanic rage when it comes to how much was robbed of me by shitty schools as a child. Shitty schools, aggressive and pompous teachers, lectures from people vastly inferior. Oh, it's monstrous. I don't want to bust anyone's eardrums, least of all my own, by ranting about that stuff, at least not at the moment. But how would it work in a free market? Well, I mean, let's say that, companies need engineers. So what's the best way to become an engineer? Well, figure out the kids who like building stuff very early on, get them into apprenticeship programs, get them to learn on the job, and give them cognitive tests to see if they fit at all. The IQ test isn't just general intelligence. You can, like, there's an object manipulation component. There is a language component and so on. And there's really G-loaded stuff. G is general intelligence. So repeating a sequence of numbers forwards is, in the IQ test, it's more G-loaded to repeat those numbers backwards because you have to manipulate them in your own mind. I used to play this game when I was daughter, you know. Spell titanium. Okay, spell it backwards, you know, because, you know, I was always kind of curious about how this stuff would work. So it would be accelerated. It wouldn't be this lazy ass 3 or 4 months off in the summer, 12 hours, maybe 15 hours of classes a week, all the time in the world. Like, they're just bribing you. It's a daycare to kill the birth rate. So when women say, well, but, you know, we were all just told to go to university. That's not the full story. Well, we were just told to pop pills for our mental ills. That's not the whole story. It's easier. It's more fun. It's less challenging. It's less scary. So women aren't being honest when they say, well, we were just propagandized into not having children. No, you were offered the bullshit Club Med of, quote, higher education, where you got loans, you didn't have to have a job, you got grants, you didn't have to work that much, you just had to parrot back what the teacher said and play hacky sack in the yard and go to dances and make out with guys, go to the bar and put on your frosh 15, right? The 15 pounds that people put on, especially if on the meal plan at university, and sell your script at 50 cents on the dollar near the end of the year. And then, you know, go get some job in the summer or travel. It's fun. It's fun. It's adult daycare. It's adult daycare. And it's even more true now, much more true now than it was when I was, because at least multiculturalism hadn't eroded standards as a whole. So when people say, oh, but we were, we were told, this is what we were told to do. This is what we were told. You know, we were just told this. Is like, yes. And why did you listen? Why did you listen? And you have to be strict with yourself, just as I have to be strict with myself. We just have to get to the root basis of the honesty that is necessary, if not to save the world, because that requires other people to be honest, but at least to save ourselves. And what needs to be talked about, what needs to be understood, is that you and I were bribed. We were bribed. Go to school, you get to live away from home, you don't have to have a job, it's loans and grants, or mommy and daddy's money, you don't have to work that hard intellectually, you just have to kind of go with the flow, and this is why the people who score higher in trait agreeableness, ladies, tend to do pretty well in school and in university, because it's not about thinking or critical thinking. It's just about parroting back leftist superstitions of the ruling classes through the high priestesses of indoctrination known as school teachers, mostly female. Oh, you know, we were told what to do. Okay, sure. But why did you listen? Rebel, rebel, right? Because in the 60s, it was like, be a rebel. In the 70s and 80s, late 70s, early 80s, it was the punk movement. Then it was the new romantics. All about being a rebel. Rebel. Don't listen to what the band says. We love the rebel. School's now forever, right? You love this stuff. We're not going to take it, right? Rebel. Rebel against what your elders tell you. Don't trust anyone over 40. Hope I die before I get old. Rebel. Okay, so why didn't you rebel? Because you were bribed. I was bribed. And maybe you didn't. I took the bribe. I took the bribe. Now, I get it. It's not much fun to work your way up and so on. And I still remember giving a presentation to a guy who was pretty high up. And I can't remember how the topic came up, but he said, I am thankfully unburdened by higher education. This guy had moved very high up in a particular organization on a high school diploma. And the stuff that I have provided the most value in the world, I learned on my own. I mean, I had many years in the corporate world based upon my IT expertise, and I taught myself IT. I did take Canada's Premier Writing Program, and that helped for sure, but most of what I have provided a value to the world in terms of creative writing, I have taught myself or explored myself. And with regards to philosophy, I did take some courses on philosophy in university, but I would say 95% of the value that I've provided to the world in terms of philosophy, self-knowledge, the voluntary family, and certainly peaceful parenting comes from my own research, thinking, and study. When I look back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. Wait, what do you think? 98%, 97, 98% of what we learn in school evaporates in our minds. Gone. Gone, baby, gone. So, why do people listen? Because it's easier. It's more fun. People want to go to school, to date, to party, to play some sports, to do some theater, to have fun. And that's what it's for. It's easier. If you say to a woman who's 18 or 19, well, you can go and do some lazy studying, have some parties, meet some guys, go on dates, have no real responsibilities, no need to get a job. You could do that for 4 years, or you could have a couple of babies. We all know which way, in general, the women are going to go. And this is not to criticize the women alone. The men are told, hey, video games and porn, man, that's going to be your fight and your reproduction. And boys find it easier a lot of times to go that route. And then we wonder why everyone's so fragile when we keep bribing them with narcoleptic ease. It's not overly shocking, is it? But until we understand that we were bribed with a very easy couple of years in college, with degrees that have, I mean, outside of a few core specialties, degrees that have virtually no economic value. I mean, the government gets you for 12 years, university gets you for another 4. That's 16 years of education, and you can do nothing really of value. I mean, I remember talking to a woman in Starbucks many years ago. She's like, oh yeah, I just completed my undergraduate in psychology. And I'm like, oh, what can you do? Nothing. But can you get a job in psychology? Nope. Well, why not? Oh, you got to do a master's and you got to be mentored and you got to do this and that and the other. So even after 16 years of education, you can't get a job. 16 years of education, you can't get a job. You can't be a doctor after 4 years. You can't be a lawyer after 4 years. You can't even be an engineer after 4 years, because I think you still have to go get your ring and stuff like that. I think engineer may be a little easier, but what can you do? Nothing. You can't do anything of value, really. And it softens people. I mean, not through any particular virtues, but just because of the harshness of the year and a half I spent up north. I worked very hard in university. But when I took a year off between undergraduate and my graduate degree, it was a terrible recession. So, and after, let's see, I mean, it was, so I did 12 years of, well, 13, sorry, did 13 years of education. And then I did 2 years English literature. I did almost 2 years theater school. Then I did 2 years of history. So that's close to two decades of education. And the only skills that I could bring to bear in the marketplace after almost 20 years of education was all of the stuff I had learned on my own. Because I did temp work and so on. I worked with Excel. I worked with WordPerfect 5.1, reveal codes for the win. So it was all the things that I had taught myself after almost 20 years of government-controlled, sponsored and funded education, after almost 20 years of education. I could only earn money by things that I had taught myself. I got nothing from the state. If I hadn't taught myself those things, if I hadn't learned computers, if I hadn't learned WordPerfect, if I hadn't learned Excel, if I hadn't learned, because people loved me when I did temp work because I could program Excel. I remember one time I went in, I was supposed to do a 2-week job of organizing spreadsheets, but I wrote code to do it and finished it in the morning of the first day. That's why they loved sending me out. But I taught myself all of that. I was teaching myself coding, and I took one computer science course in high school where we filled in punch cards and you'd send them in and get them back the next day. That's how ancient it was. That's how useless it was. The absolutely shocking waste of human capital that goes into all of this stuff is absolutely horrendous. It's like a wildfire of endless temptation that burns through the minds of the young and leaves them with virtually nothing. Well, it leaves you economically negative because you don't have any marketable or productive skills and you're in debt. And I remember seeing an economics professor once go through, you know, he said, you know, I've got hours. I have office hours. You can come to me with any problems. Just come to chat about economics. Nobody comes. He's like, no, this whole term, nobody's come. Like, you're paying for this. And he went through the whole thing. And this is like, I don't know, 30 years ago. It was like $250,000 to $300,000 in direct costs and opportunity costs, because you go to school not making money in the marketplace. And he said, so you're spending, you know, like $300,000, this is US, right? So that'd be about 420 Canadian. So somewhere between quarter mil and half a mil, you're spending, and you get free coaching, instruction, one-on-one, and nobody goes. So you're further behind economically. I remember talking to this professor, and he said, you know, I mean, you take a history degree, that's fine, but you should probably take something like economics, because you can't do anything with a history degree, but at least with economics, you have a small chance of being able to do something, because it shows your math and statistics and blah, 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 right? Well, I prefer Austrian economics, which is about human beings rather than numbers. But you get nothing. So we are lured, we are tempted, we are offered. And we are offered an easy, fun life into our 20s in school, in university, in college, in uni, and we take it. And we don't have kids until much later, because then you graduate and you're like, well, I've just graduated. I'm 22, 23, 24. I should probably get a job now. And then you start grinding away in your cubicle or doing whatever you're doing. And then you're like, well, this kind of sucks. Well, maybe I should go get a graduate degree. Yeah, why not? And you go and do that. And then it's like, well, geez, I got to get back into the workforce, 28, 29, 30. Then you look around, most of the good people are gone. And even if you luck out and get the right guy and start having kids, you get one, maybe two, maybe three on the outside. But at 32, you're 14 years past when you sort of started having kids. I mean, evolutionarily speaking or historically speaking, could be even earlier, but we'll just go with adulthood. Right? At 32, you're 14 years past, and that's why the birth rate is down. Because we're bribed with sex, sleeping in, drugs, fun, parties, self-exploration. Like, we're all that fascinating. I mean, I've got a pretty active mind. I don't find myself that interesting. I find the good that I can do in the world and the good that I can do if for the people around me, I find that interesting, but I don't find it super fascinating to just regard myself. Ooh, what am I thinking about this? So, there's an old David Spade routine, which always stuck with me, where he's talking about visiting a friend who's a stoner in the basement, who's constantly staring at the fish tank and saying, oh yeah, that yellow fish, he really likes hanging out in the back corner there. Well, that's sort of self-knowledge, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with self-knowledge, right? If you've got a bad temper, you've got to figure out where it's coming from. Yeah, that's important. For sure, but the purpose of a car is to drive it, not to tinker with it or fix it or figure out everything about how every part of it works. The purpose of the car is to get you from A to Z or A to B, not to tinker forever. You know, like that old Scott Adams things about, I'm going to play with the settings on my computer until something breaks, and then I'm going to consider myself productive when I fix it. 32-bit disk access. So we're bribed. And the academics come along and say, oh, yeah, come over here. You don't have to start adulthood. You don't have to be a parent. You don't have to be responsible. You don't have to grow up. We'll just put you in this daycare, this adult daycare, where you barely have to work. You're going to have a lot of fun, and you're going to get soft and fat and indebted, which means you're not going to be able to rock the boat too much when you get out of school. Oh, and we'll program you to hate your history and your culture as well. And that's tempting. And that's tempting. And same thing with SSRIs. Oh, you don't have to confront your history, your trauma, your family. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You don't have to be brutally honest with people who were brutal to you. No, we just take some pills. You don't have to diet and exercise. We'll just give you insulin. But at least insulin is treating an objective disorder. It can be measured. So secondary gains. We're bribed. We should be aware of that. We should be honest about that. Why is the birth rate down? Because pretty sinister people bribe us to choose hedonism over adulthood, to choose fun over children. Not that children aren't fun, but one of the reasons why people want to go to university is because their high school experiences are so miserable that they're kind of burnt out, depressed, and exhausted by the end of it. It's like, man, I could use a vacation from this terrible government school and exams and right. And shitty jobs that you get when you're a teenager, which, you know, of course, that makes sense, right? Because you don't have any skills. So people kind of depressed and burned out by the end of high school. It's like, oh, man, I could use some fun. And you go on these college tours. Like, oh, here's the gym. Here's the theater. You know, here's the quad. Look, they're playing Frisbee golf at the quad. You get these little trams. They're going to pick you up, take you all over college. It's perfectly safe. Here's the dorm room. Co-ed showers. Wink, wink. Come to the hell of hedonism and you'll have fun. And it would never be that way in the free market at all. So, yeah, that's sort of what I wanted to get across when women say, we were sort of told to go to college. We were told to do this. We were told to do that. It's like, yeah, but why did you listen? Lots of people tell you lots of things. Lots of people tell you lots of things. Why do you listen to the one that's easiest in the short run and most fun in the moment? Because the people who are bribing you know a lot about how to bribe you. They know a lot about human temptation. They know they're devilish. They know a lot about human temptation. They know a lot about how to sell stuff to people. And they're very good at what they do. Like con men, con women are very good at what they do. They know which buttons to push. They know who to target, how to seduce them into doing what they want. So it's not necessarily shameful to have been seduced into abandoning procreation and adulthood for the sake of adult academic daycares, but it's not what you were told, it's why you listened. And if you're really strict with yourself about why you listened, it's because it was easier, it was more fun, it was better. And deep down you knew that you were choosing the easy path. You knew that. As did I. Everybody knows it deep down. Why do people grab at pills? Because it's easier than confronting child abuse. Why do people jump into adult daycare? Because it's easier than going out into the world. I mean, I've told lots of people to do the right thing. I've had like a billion views and downloads over the last 20 years. I've told a lot of people to do the right thing. They don't listen to me because what I offer is diet and exercise, not a pill with horrible side effects. So if people gravitate towards the person giving them the free, cheap, and easy route as opposed to the high, hard, difficult road, they can't blame that they were told. Because I, and of course countless other people, say, well, you have to do the right thing, or you should do the right thing. It's going to be hard as hell, but it's going to be worthwhile. And it's, you get to actually know that you're doing the right thing in this world, even though it means evildoers will hate you. You know, all the people who were like, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm a moral hero. I'm a brave guy. I'm a brave woman. What I'm going to do is I'm going to criticize white Christian males. Oh, look at my moral heroism. It's delectable and delicious. It's a river of caramel wider and deeper than the Ganges. Look how brave. I'm going to call someone who's white a racist. Oh, wow. Look at my moral heroism. Well, that's just pretend morality. That's just bullying carefully curated victims for the sake of pretending to be morally brave and strong. So it's not what people dangle in front of you. It's what you choose to swallow. It's what you choose to bite. There's a buffet, right? Why did you eat pierogies? Well, there was a buffet. Well, that doesn't answer anything. A buffet has like 1,000 things on it. Why did you eat the pierogies only? Well, they were in the buffet. That doesn't answer anything. Why did you choose this? Well, because it was recommended. Well, lots of things are recommended. Lots of things are praised. You can't blame the buffet for your choices, and you can't say, I did what I did because the world told me to, because the world is full of a whole bunch of things that people tell you to do. And it's still on you who and what you choose. All right. If anybody has, thank you for your patience with my ranty rant. But if you have questions, it doesn't have to be about this topic, whatever's on your mind. I'm certainly happy to help and chat if you want, or you may just be stunned by the illumination and wish to process and digest on your own. All right. We have a brave caller, or maybe not brave. JJ, what's on your mind? Don't forget to unmute. Go ahead.
First off, thank you for the past few Flash live streams. They've been very refreshing. I feel like it's what nobody has been saying the past. I kind of went through a 10-year self-exploration journey myself, kind of crawling out of hell. What you're saying about the birth rate is true. I'm 32, and I have like this crazy burning desire now after all of this discovery, conflict, things of that sort, and just, I would say, rebranding myself to be the man that I want to be. So I know, I think about university. I went to university also. So I went there to go for quote-unquote pre-med, but I didn't have the math skills, so I studied how would you say this? What the hell? I heard there's some sticks. A grievance study.
Humanities, like yeah.
So,
AKA Whitey Bad, Male Bad.
Yeah, pretty much. So I didn't like what I was studying, but I was just trying to hurry up and get out of university just so I can get into the workforce, because I was like, all I'm doing is delaying the inevitable. And so even in high school, I couldn't get a job to save my life. And I was like, all right, I either got to join the military or I got to go to college, because I couldn't get a job at the refinery. I couldn't get a job at McDonald's. I'm talking nobody would take me. The trait that I saw, kind of obvious, they're hiring people from like other demographics or other countries, I would just say flat out. They're not hiring any men, let alone any men with any testosterone. I was losing my shit as a teen. So yeah, I definitely took the easy route, but trying to take a better route. I studied that in university, complete waste of time, complete shit show there. I was like, this is all a joke. I thought, because leading up to college, I read a book every week for about a year and a half, 2 years, and I journaled every day for about 2 years also. So I thought when I got to uni, I thought people were going to be self-reflective, all into just education and wisdom, and I guess liberal in terms of like a free mind, not like political views. That's what I thought I was going to experience, but instead it was just a complete daycare. And I think about the birth rate because, I mean, yeah, I wanted kids early. If I was like, holy shit, like I don't have any skills. I can't get a job. I have no income. But coming out of university, I mean, that was like the hardest. Those first 2-3 years were like absolute hell. And once I got on my feet, COVID hit.
So you mean after university?
Yes, after university.
Sorry, go ahead.
And then right after, I finally got on my feet. I got into sales. I was making a little bit of coin, not a lot, but just some coin to like feel good about myself. COVID hit.
Okay, so sorry. I get to the COVID stuff in a sec. But brother, what happened with the sales skills? How did you, because you don't generally get those in university. So how did you develop the sales skills? Were you mentored or you have a good talent that way or you read books? So how did you get the sales stuff going?
Yeah, so the reality was right after college, I had got into education because I had a useless degree. And I said, hey, I need a skill that's going to pay me and it's going to be worth my time investment. So how I got it, I had a mentor when I got into the gig, my managing partner, right? So, I mean, I guess I would say I had a, because I had read so much before going into it, I think that gave me an advantage coming in. And then I just wanted it so badly, like just sheer willpower. Like I wasn't going into any other field. I was not going back to college. Like this had to work. And I would just say, I'm kind of a smart dude. I am a little bit nervous about my intelligence, just based off of one of your tweets about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Oh, what saying was the online tweet?
It was like, yeah, online IQ tests are bullshit. And I was like, oh God, like I might not be as hot as I think I am. I saw some guy on your thread. He was like, I thought I was hot. Came out on my 97.5. I was like, oh shit, I might not be that hot. Cause I tested 127 on the low end and then 130 on the high end. I was like, oh, okay, like
and
I'm solid.
It may be, right? It may be. Because some of those things will coincide. But yeah. My wife is an expert and all of that. So yeah, I mean, the online stuff, it's not like useless, but it's not as accurate. So it doesn't mean that you're not. You could, in fact, even be higher under an IQ test. It's just that they're not, they're more of a scattershot. It's like shooting an arrow blindfold. You might still hit the target. So I wouldn't say that my sort of skepticism of online IQ tests indicates that you're lower. It could be higher. Could be. So I wouldn't take that as a any kind of indicator. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So for me, like with sales, I was just like, I am not going anywhere. First off, the lifestyle that I had, not like the income that I had, but just the lifestyle to do as I want, when I want it, how I want it. And I got to be around some like big players that were making real coin, like 7 figures, right? And I looked at their lifestyle. They had credibility. And the fact that their children loved them, they were in their kids' lives, they were married. And it really revamped my whole, the way I thought. Because it wasn't until I turned 28 that I actually understood that parents are supposed to help their children, right? I thought everything was supposed to be hard up until a few years in the sales game. So to kind of answer your question, how I kind of got the knack for it, I mean, I've been a well-read kid, like all throughout kind of elementary, middle school, and kind of fell off in high school. But yeah, I read a book every week before the 2 years I went to university, journaled every day for 2 years. And I mean, because I would say, maybe not causal, but because I mean, kind of usual stuff, not having any love, I'm probably was trying to seek the approval of others. So I would try to be me plus. I think you coined that phrase, the me plus. And I think that's what it is. And I got into an industry where it was based on logic and not just twisting somebody's arm and being unethical. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of what perception.
No, I appreciate that. It's a great update. And I'm sorry, I rudely interrupted you right when you were about to get to your COVID story. So if you could continue with that, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. So I had started to have some decent little success. Nothing for me, it was not like, oh, I'm making all this money. But for me, because it was pure commission, right? I started having consistent income coming in. I could buy better suits, right? Point being, I had this deal coming up with the company. Supposed to be like a nice deal, right? A solid payout. COVID hit, kind of sidewinded everything. I'm in a coastal city, so the lockdown hit pretty fucking hard. People were losing their minds. And with how it relates to like birth rate and all of that, instead of me sourcing for like a woman that could, you know, be a good mother for my children, I opted for satisfying my some of my itches that I had. And so I got off from selling. Like, I wasn't working nearly as hard. I'm trying to find like a unifying point behind it all. But with the birth rate and then COVID, what I had learned is just like, and tying it back to the flash stream you did about the boomers last week, like I really learned to just say, yo, I don't care about anyone else except me, right? And I'll pause right there because I've kind of spewed out a lot of information.
No, that's fine. So you're 32 now, and what are your dating, marriage, reproductive options or choices at the moment? What's out there?
Yeah, so last week I had went for like a hike on Friday. Bumped into this one girl. She was getting out of her car, coming back to my car to get my hiking shoes. Chatted her up. We walked up the mountain, came back down, got her number, had a little connection. She mentioned a few things. I won't put all of it out there, but SSRIs came up, right? I mentioned my kind of journey kind of as an open book. We went on another date. We went, I'll say where we went. The point being, she had the kind of the, what's the phrase? Like the indicators, like the, she had a green, it was a green light from the chat, right? But it's crazy because so she was 30 and I was like, hey, you know, what are your non-negotiables kind of in somebody? She didn't really have an answer. She eventually came up with some. But the main thing she was looking for was someone who was a good hang around her friends. And in my head, I'm like,
sorry, a good what?
A good hang, like a good, like a Barbie, like a Ken the Barbie, how you're just like,
oh,
around.
Somebody that her friends would envy.
No, kind of like Ken the Barbie, how you're just there.
Yeah.
You're kind of cute, but you don't really say much. You're just like a supporting.
Candy.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was what she was looking for. And I'm like, all right, that's, you're 30. You should kind of know for sure what you want because you don't have much time. And she knew that. She's like, yeah, the clock is ticking. I'm aware. But what really threw me off and what really made me unattracted to her was that she said, you know, I do drink. I go out maybe once a month and I might smoke a little bit of marijuana occasionally. And for me, I mean, that's after doing therapy, journaling, reading books every week, right? I don't find any satisfaction in any of that stuff. Like I get nothing from drinking, right? If I ever drink, it's out of like, okay, I'm in a social environment for work and to not just be a complete oddball out. I'll have a bourbon neat, limited to one drink, maybe two if I'm there alone, but I'm definitely not smoking. So when she said that, it was kind of like, man, you're actually a good enough of an opportunity. She was pretty face, blonde hair, blue eyes. I mean, she dyed her hair, but she could pull it off as natural. Blonde, blue eyes, 5'2". Nice smile, real soft skin, useless degree, right? But she came from wealth. And so to answer your question, what I would say my dating life is for me, I feel like I have to play catch up because, well, let me pause right there and make sure that you follow every day.
Yeah. And what does she, what industry does she work in?
Entertainment.
Okay. And is it the kind of job that she would ditch to have kids? Because that's a big question to ask. If you want to homeschool, if you want to have, you know, breastfeeding for 18 months and two or three kids, I mean, she's going to be knocked out of the workplace for 10 to 12 years. Is it the kind, because it's the thing, say, oh, yeah, why do men not want to date lawyers or doctors? And it's like, it's not, oh, they're so smart. It's like, no, we love intelligent women. That's great. You got to have a conversation for the next 40 years. You want someone smart around. It's because they're not going to ditch those careers to raise your kids, which means some stranger's going to raise your kids. And it's a weird kind of polygamy to say, well, here's my first wife and she goes to work. And here's my second wife and she's the maid and the cook. And here's my third wife and she's the nanny to raise the kids. And it's like, it's this bizarre Middle Eastern planet where the female labor is divvied up and it's not considered cheating on your kids. So does she have the kind of job where she'd say, oh yeah, kids, yeah, I'll definitely take that over what I'm doing here.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I kind of already broke it off with her after a couple of dates. It was no point of me even trying to get sex out of her or have her get sex out of me, just because getting emotionally attached and then splitting, it's not, the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
Well, right? and the opportunity costs of a better woman might come along while you're wasting time with Blondie, right?
Exactly.
Right. And the other thing too is you don't know the person. I mean, if they're on SSRIs, it's like, I don't know who you are because it's their personality altering. So how do I know what you're like if you're not on SSRIs? I don't know. So, you know, I mean, you could be better, you could be worse, but you won't be the same. Exactly. So it is not, you know, it's like meeting someone who's high. It's like, I don't know who you are because I'm really only talking to the drugs, not the person.
Yeah. So like for me, my dating life, so marriage, I want kids, at least three, maybe more. So I would say, so back to the point, I'll say that I feel like I'm playing catch up because my high school dating was stymied. College dating was like stymied just from being extremely stressed. So with the birth rate stuff, everything you said, I mean, it really hits home. And like for me now, I'm like, for me, like I have all these bells ringing. Like, all right, you got to figure something out now. Like you can't, you have to have your filters up. You can't say, oh, well, she's good looking enough. Well, I mean, that is true. But I mean, like in terms of like the non-negotiables, because this chick, she was like, oh, now that I think about it, oh, no MAGA. What else did she say? She was like, no MAGA. And she made that a big point. And I was like, why is that such a big point for you? She was like,
yeah, I mean, if you're straight, don't you want a MAGA guy? Because leftist men are halfway to women.
Yeah. But she was like, no MAGA. And so I told her, I was like, look, even if she brought up religion too. I was like, look, whether you like Trump, hate Trump, particularly, I don't care for the guy all that much. But I'm not a hater, right? I give the devil his due. Life, love him, hate him. Like, he's accomplished some great things in his own life with respect, right? Respectfully. But I was like, look, people that focus on politics have some underlying issues. Like that should not be the first subject that comes up in a conversation.
That's not anything to do with you. That's just to do with her friends. Because women who don't get married tend to bond with their often loser single female friends. And then it's like, it's not whether she cares about MAGA. It's whether her friends will be like, you're dating a red cap? Oh my God, what's the matter with you? Right. So that's the issue. And there's a funny thing, too, which is sort of a modern phenomenon. Hey, can I just get your permission to rant for a moment? Would you mind?
Yeah, go ahead.
And this comes from some personal experience. And I will also add, and you know who it is, if you're listening, a friend of mine went through this rather recently, which I found outrageous. Outrageous. So I won't get into any details, but a friend of mine started getting involved with a woman in her 30s, heavily in debt, didn't like her job. And boy, does she have demands. Boy, and it's like this woman, honey, you're in your 30s. You got to lower your demands a little bit. If nobody's hiring you, you have to lower your salary requirements. Well, I want to be paid $1 million a day to scroll TikTok. All right. Anybody offering you that money? No. Okay, $2 million a day, $3 million. It's like, no, you're going in the wrong direction. You don't ask for more. When you have less to offer, you don't ask for more when no one's hiring you as it is. If I were to say, well, I'm not going to do a show unless I get at least $10,000 in donations before I start. Well, let's just say there'd be a whole lot of radio silence because I ain't no big shot that way. So women in their 30s, I remember in my early 30s, I dated a woman in her late 30s. And I won't get into any particular details, of course. It's not her fault that I have a public platform quarter century later or more. But she had a kind of nothing job, late 30s. Oh my God, did she have demands? This is the woman who told me, you know who's really attractive? You know who's really attractive? David Beckham. I mean, my gosh. I mean, I think he's got hair plugs, but let's forget that for a moment. He's good looking. He's got a great physique. He's made a lot of money. And I'm like, yeah, I'll agree with you. David Beckham is very attractive for a woman. Tall, good looking, charismatic, great physique, lots of money. Yeah, he's very attractive. No question. But he married a Spice Girl. And even he seems to be somewhat exasperated by her from time to time. You know that meme? Be honest, right? So that's the wildest thing, is this absolute inability to adapt to lower demand and higher need. And it's tough for women because, of course, when they're very young, guys, if they're reasonably attractive, guys are throwing themselves at them like kamikazes on a battleship. And maybe that's not quite the right analogy, but I think you get the general imagery. And so they're used to just, you know, fending and fielding off all of these guys. And of course, because these guys are looking mostly for sexual access rather than full commitment, they can get much more attractive guys because a woman's sexual market value isn't based upon, and I see that somebody else wants to talk. I'll talk to you in a sec. Appreciate your patience. A woman's sexual market value is not based on who'll sleep with her. It's based on who'll get down on one knee, pull out a ring, and propose. That's your true value. My true value, when I was in the workforce and I was looking for work, my true value wasn't the interview. Hey, look, I got a lot of interviews. I'm sure I can pay rent with that. Nope, interviews are a cost. It's job offers. It's the only thing that counts. Well, interviews are necessary but not sufficient to get job offers. But going for an interview, especially when I can fake my resume. Let's say I can just lie about my resume. I can just make up stuff. Oh, I got this degree and I had this experience. Just make stuff up. Just lie. You know, like makeup and Spanx and reducing your body count verbally, right? So let's just say I can lie. Oh, look at that. I've got a great career because I can lie on my resume and get tons of interviews. But the moment they do any background checks, they never hire me. Oh, look. I lied on my resume and I got an interview as a surgeon. You know, that surgeon makes $350,000 a year, baby. That's just money in the bank. No, it's not. What's money in the bank is this thing called actual money in the bank. So women are so used to being in demand because they subsidize everything with sexual access a lot, not always, but a lot. And they don't understand that your sexual market value, your romantic value, is not on men who'll sleep with you. It's on men who will marry you. It's not on men who want to put their dick in you, but want to get a baby out of you and stick around to raise it. That's what you're worth. But then because women are so heavily subsidized throughout their 20s with sexual access without the requirement for genuine commitment, and they really have a tough time noticing the passage of time, and what they do is they say, well, I am more valuable now at 34 than I was at 24, because at 24... I didn't even have a degree. I didn't even have an income. I didn't even have a career. I didn't even have travel under my belt. I didn't even have more experience in the world. It's like, that's not a value to a man. Because quality men want to marry a woman whose values they share so she can bring up the children and the values that they share. So if a woman says, well, I'm more valuable because of my income, my career, my education, my travel, my romantic experience, my money. No, that's what women find attractive in men, not what men find attractive in women. This weird solipsism where women think that what they find attractive in a man is exactly what men will find attractive in women. Like, Both sexes are equally attractive for exactly the same reason. One just happens to come with boobs is not even remotely true. And this is because women have given up asking what men want. Why is it so hard to get a man? It's like, well, have you asked men what they want and striven to provide it? No. They say, well, if I will find somebody with a career and an income attractive, then I'm sure the man will find a woman with a career and an income attractive. Nope. Because we want women to stay home and raise our children. There's not much point having an income to pay some non-native English speaker from some incompatible culture a whole bunch of money after taxes to raise your children in the ways of the Middle East or North Africa or wherever. Nope. That's not a thing. It's like, for a woman, it's like, I want to get married to a guy so that I can have long, deep conversations and perhaps sex with a completely different guy. Well, I want to marry a woman who's going to be the mother of my children, but I don't want her to actually be the mother of my children. I'll outsource that. So women in their 30s are beyond confused about where they stand. You know, if I'm selling a house for X dollars and nobody's offering it, nobody's making any offers, maybe a couple of people come by and have a look at it and they're like, whoa, no, thank you. That's like dating, right? Oh, I've had a look at the inside and it's a bit moldy. It's a bit scabby. You know, things falling off the walls, exposed pipes, whatever, right? So I got a house and I'm selling it. A couple of people come by. I don't get a single offer. And they're like, you know what? I'm going to raise the price. Nope. If you're not getting any offers, you got to lower the price. And if you're not getting any offers of marriage, you must lower your standards, lower your requirements, lower your demands. Or it's all complete nonsense. And that's another thing that kills the birth rate, is that women are told to never settle. And that's just demonic vanity that kills the birth rate. You deserve it all. You're a princess. Nope. If you were a princess, you'd be married off to some inbred Habsburg for the sake of cementing a military alliance. But that's not what's happening these days. Thank you. Great call. I appreciate that. All right, Kale. I do believe we have talked before. What is on your mind, my friend? Don't forget to unmute. Hello, hello. Hello. Merry Christmas. How you doing?
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call again. I was just going to say, you know, I resonated a lot with what you were talking about earlier about the public school and the rage you feel after getting all that time wasted.
Stolen!
Stolen for sure. And just kind of, I call it kind of a public school hangover, to where when this it's all over and you finally get yourself back to health, you have this moment of clarity and you realize that you know nothing. And kind of like when I was in university, sadly, when I get hungover and I had a test the next day, you know, I wouldn't want to study at all. My curiosity would be at a depleted. But now in my mid-30s, I feel like that hangover has finally gone away. And just like the other caller was saying, I have this untapped thirst for real knowledge and curiosity and truth and trying to learn new skills. And it's just it's been a nightmare, honestly. I mean, I'm glad you had that talk about it. I don't think people are acknowledging it enough about how much anger and resentment and disappointment about having to restart and hit the factory reset button on your perspectives on life and everything and what you really wanted to be. And I can't explain. I guess I haven't really realized how angry and enraged I've been with all that lost time. So any tips on, like you were saying, you talked about this rage. Any tips on how to manage that, on what you can do to
just pour bottomless contempt onto people who are advocates of government education? Because this is what people do. They say, oh, well, we have to raise the minimum wage. Nope. No, you don't. Not at all. What you have to have is government schools that produce people who aren't economic dead weights, depressed, burnt out, useless because of shitty government schools. The problem is not that the exploitive, nasty, evil capitalists just won't pay people a living wage. The problem is that after 12 years in government school, people are useless as tits in a bull in the free market. And people say, oh, we gotta teach. We gotta pay the teachers more. Nope. No, you don't. There's absolutely zero correlation between teacher pay and student performance. Can you imagine somebody's a really great teacher, but because they're only making $80,000 a year with 2 months off in the summer, you can't get fired, endless benefits and pensions. They say, well, I could be a really great teacher and really inspire my children, but until I get $83,000 or $84,000 a year, I'm just going to be really shitty. I'm just going to yell at them. But boy, if you give me a couple of grand more a year, I'm going to become a great teacher. Imagine that. Imagine. I mean, that would be like me saying, well, unless I get a certain amount of donations every show, I'm going to do bad shows, have bad conversations. That would be terrible because I should have the passion for philosophy itself. So the way that you get rid of the rage, or the way at least you act on the rage, is when people start talking about what's needed and necessary in government schools, you say, nope, they're terrible. You graduated at grade 12. What could you do economically? What value could you add? What did you know about law, economics, business, profit, loss, setting up a corporation, running a business, corporate taxes? What did you know about anything of any value in the marketplace? What did you know about sales, marketing, tech, accounting, corporate structures? What did you know about corporations as a whole? The pluses and minuses, the liabilities and the shields. What did you know about customer service? What did you know about, did you know what EBITDA means? Earnings before interest, taxes, interest, depreciation. What did you know about anything to do with the corporate world or the business world or profit or loss? What did you know anything about entrepreneurship? Did you know anything about how to manage people? Did you know anything about how to evaluate a business? Did you know anything about how to read a balance sheet? Did you know anything about anything that might give you even the tiniest shred of economic value? Well, in order to wallpaper over absolutely shitty government schools, we've got to force people trying to run a business to pay above market rates for brains that the government has almost completely shredded and destroyed. Crazy. So yeah, I guess it's just sadists who really are pro-government schools these days, just pure sadists. I don't understand it at all. Like, how could you have gone through government schools for 12 years and think that they're anything other than brain-shredding indoctrination centers? I don't know, maybe if you were a sadistic bully and you're like, government schools were great. You know why? Because they herded and forced little kids that I could bully and terrorize into an enclosed environment for me. That was great. Fantastic. I didn't have to go out and hunt victims who might be able to fight back. They put me around kids half my size. I could shake them by the neck and get all the lunch money I wanted. Maybe those are the people who like government schools. Or, of course, the people who are very big and keen on indoctrination. They sure love those government schools, too. But just, I never let it go by. Like, if I see it online or if I'm in person and somebody starts talking about government schools, oh, the teachers are so heroic and noble. No, they're not. No, they're not. If they were heroic and noble, they'd be coaching and tutoring in the free market, in the private sector, online, podcasts, whatever, right? I mean, think of all the people that I've educated on philosophy over the last 20 years. Probably easy 50 to 100 mil people, right? That's assuming 5 to 10 podcasts each, billion people, or billion downloads. Tens of millions, at least. Maybe 100 million, maybe more. Of course, there's books as well. How many people have I exposed to philosophy? Population of a couple of major countries. I did that for the love and passion of philosophy and a sincere desire to help the world, and freedomain.com/donate. I appreciate that too. But now teachers, they don't have any control over me anymore, so I could be honest. No, they are indoctrinators. They are exploiters. They are liars. They are greedy. They are entitled. They are leftist females for the most part, and leftist males, of course, too. So yeah, the way that you overcome your outrage at having had 12 years of your life worse than stolen from you, but like, it's one thing if somebody steals from you. It's another thing if they steal from you and break your legs. So it's not just that you lost 12 years, it's that you emerged cynical, embittered, traumatized, angry. And if you say the truth about this to people, they kind of freak out, if that makes sense. Does that help at all? And sorry for the silent bit earlier. Oh, I think we lost him. All right. Any other questions, issues, challenges, problems? Really appreciate your time today. I will, of course, I don't think we're doing a show tomorrow night. It's Christmas Eve, right? So yeah, we're in sort of Christmas hours. At the moment, a couple of housekeeping items. Of course, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. shop.freedomain.com for your merch. peacefulparentingbook.com for the book. And we now have a print version of my novel, The Present, which actually I wrote after I wrote my novel, The Future. But my novel, The Present, is now available. fdrurl.com/presentprint. fdrurl.com/presentprint, which is the print version of my novel, The Present, which is very good. It's a very good book, in my humble and completely objective and unbiased opinion. So lots of love from up here, my friends. Thank you so much for a wonderful chat, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.